Transfer complete.
Hello and welcome to Subspace Transmissions, the podcast where two Trek fans step into the arena and tackle the best, worst, weirdest, wildest, and everything in between that Star Trek has to offer. I'm Cam Smith, and joining me on the bridge,
this is Tyler Orton reporting for duty.
And this week, it's time to wrap up the TNG two-parters. This episode, ranking the TNG two-part episodes.
I think it's, you know, no coincidence that we have 10 fingers on our hands and we've got 10 episodes to go over, Cam.
That's, yes, very true.
It's crazy to think that we started this, I guess, 10 or I guess it would be 11 months ago at this point, that we went through all of these after first reviewing all the films in the franchise.
It's funny because I remember when we started these and, you know, we were talking kind of ahead about Voyager and Deep Space Nine. I was like, just like laughing kind of internally, like, that is so far off. And it's like, I think we're starting Emissary, like, next month.
Yeah, and I think just for listeners, just to let you guys know, yeah, we're going to start reviewing the DS9 two-parters, and then I guess once DS9 and Voyager start running parallel with each other, timeline-wise, I guess we'll go back and forth between DS9 and Voyager two-part episodes.
I think that works so we don't, because some people don't really like DS9 and some don't like Voyager. This way we kind of please both sides.
Yeah.
And we're all about pleasing everyone. We're shameless people pleasers.
But I'll say this, even if you don't care for one series or the other, I think we'll still have enough fun with it that you guys would still be able to appreciate, you know, some of our critiques of other episodes.
Very much so.
And because we have fun with the episode critiques, you know?
I love doing them.
Yeah, so.
And I'm really looking forward to talking about Sisko's beachwear in Emissary.
Yes. Well, let's get started, Cam. Why don't we just do kind of the ranks in descending order? Why don't we start with you? What would you rank as your number 10 and why when it comes to two-parters?
My least favorite two-parter in TNG. I think this is fairly obvious to anyone who's listened to them thus far.
Okay, I've got a guess, but I'll let you go and say it first.
It's Gambit.
Is it? Okay.
Yes.
That's what I thought you were going to say, which good because it's not the same as mine, and we can go into that in just a few moments. But tell me why you put Gambit at the very bottom of your list.
To me, Gambit is not the most criminal stretching out into a two-parter, but it's the one that feels like the biggest drag to sit through.
Okay.
To me, this episode just feels like a 45-minute episode really just stretched to the almost to the exact breaking point of what a single episode could be to two parts. It has a really dull adversary who has way too much screen time. And I just felt like it wants to be this swashbuckling, fun-time adventure. Those movies are really fast-paced and fun. They are not like Gambit.
Yeah, we discussed how this was, you know, Next Gen's version of Indiana Jones.
Yeah.
This is not exactly Indiana Jones, but...
No, and there was a lot of Indiana Jones ripoffs that came out in the wake of Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Yeah.
This is like those. This is King Solomon's Mines.
Well, you know what? I thought Gambit was far more swashbuckling than you did. I believe our guest for that episode was one Andy Chan.
Mm-hmm.
He cared for that one, too.
Yeah, he was a big fan of it.
Yeah, to me, I mean, there's enough, you know, kind of funness to this. Like, I do agree with you with the adversary. I don't remember the guy's name, but he was the most boring villain ever.
At least in a two-parter, yeah.
Yeah, and he just wasn't very memorable, and it was, like, nobody understood why everybody was in fear of him other than his little remote control. And
right.
We were like, well, why didn't people just go and, like, I don't know, stun him with a phaser and take the controller away?
Or kill him in his sleep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It didn't make any sense to me. But honestly, and Andy agreed, like, I had fun watching this episode. I mean, there's that issue I agree with regards to stretching it out a little bit longer than it deserved to be. And that's one of the things we're always trying to address in our reviews of two-parters is, does this justify itself as a two-part episode, or should it have just been a one-part episode?
Right.
Look, if I could, you know, go back in time, I would push the producers to maybe make this more of a one-parter. I think it would have been a much stronger episode. But to say that it's the worst, I would not agree with that myself.
It was the one I enjoyed the least, and the one that, you know, we talk about be fun. And a lot of these episodes, and maybe even ones two-parters that I don't really like that much, had moments that were really fun to me. This one is really, really sparse on those.
Well, you know what? If you get to watch, you know, Picard and Riker, you know, give each other grief on board a ship.
Sure.
Play acting, That's kind of fun to me.
Let the good times roll.
Okay, well, why don't we move on to my number 10, Cam? And you bring up the fact, you know, like stretching an episode unjustifiably across two parts when maybe, just maybe it deserves one part.
Mm-hmm.
I have to give my number 10 to Birthright.
That's my number 9.
Okay, yeah. Well, we can go talk about that in depth between the two of us. Birthright, it's just like, the only thing I actually do quite appreciate about it is Data's beeline, where he's having all these dreams about his father, and we do see some cool like sequences there. Mm-hmm. With the dreaming there. But the Worf storyline, I don't even know if it justifies itself as a one-part episode. Like, I'm not invested in anything that's going on here.
Yeah, I kind of agree. I mean, the Worf story, at least in part two, because it's not really in part one, is definitely not that interesting.
Yeah.
But I think it's an okay concept for an episode. I mean, we would see it kind of done better with Hippocratic Oath.
Sure.
But I think there's enough there that I'm like, okay, it's at least memorable in kind of a goofy way, you know, with them throwing spears through, like, hoops and things like that.
It's what we always love to joke about.
Yeah, and the reason this wasn't in my bottom was because it had enough stuff that I kind of enjoyed, even if I agree with you 100%, why is this a two-parter? But you know what? Like, I enjoyed seeing, you know, Bashir show up in part one. Like, the DS9 stuff is fun to me, even if it doesn't inspire much of a satisfying 45 minutes of television.
No. I mean, there's other stuff like that kid talk or Tork, or, you know, him singing songs and dressing in Klingon armor.
Right.
You know, there's some redeemable stuff here.
And we got a lot of laughs out of Worf's love interest in part two.
His child love interest. We could not figure out how old she was supposed to be, and it was kind of frightening.
They look old for their age, too.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, Birthright, to me, that's just such a... The way that I went and reviewed all these or determined which order I wanted to put them in is the one that I'd have the toughest time rewatching.
Mm-hmm.
To me, if you made me rewatch Gambit, I'd be okay with that. But Birthright, I'm like, oh, please, no. Like,
really?
Don't make me watch that again. You bring up that it's an okay, or it's a decent concept. I think the issue here is just execution. And like that first half of the two-parter, it's just what Worf searching around in a shuttlecraft for a while, landing on a planet, and then we get going with the storyline. The first part is actually, I was very much interested in what Data was doing, more so than Worf.
I agree completely. Like, I really do. I remember watching Birthright originally and really kind of digging the first part on with DS9. I was really hoping for kind of a spin of that story in part one to continue with maybe a little more DS9 stuff.
Yeah.
And then that was completely not the case. I very much agree. It feels like, well, there's the ongoing question of, like, why is this a two-parter? I'm not sure.
I think the other fault in this is, okay, so we get the actual, what the episode's most remembered for is the prison camp mm-hmm. stuff going on. I never felt any sort of tension. I never believed Worf was in any danger at any point. I never thought he was going to be stuck in this prison camp. And so then you're asked to invest in all these characters who you met just over the course of, like, 42 minutes.
Right.
And I didn't find any of them all that engaging, and I just didn't find their story all that compelling.
Did you get anything out of Worf sort of becoming a mentor for Klingon rights to these people?
It made me think why he couldn't do that for his own son very well.
It's true. He liked talk a lot more than Alexander.
Yeah. Okay, well, Cam, what we started with your number 10. Mm-hmm. Why don't we start and go on to my number 9 then?
Yes.
Okay, so I want to do, and it feels as if, you know, people might think, oh, I'm just picking on an obvious target here, but my number 9 is Encounter at Far Points.
Interesting.
Which is a series premiere, of course, of Star Trek The Next Generation. I do recall, like, when we sat down to watch it almost a year ago, it was, there's some entertaining parts in it.
There sure are.
Mostly us laughing at stuff. You know, whether it's the, you know, what's the guy's name? Zor or something? The administrator of the Farpoint station. Him arguing about apples.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a lot of, you know, weird stuff going on with Wesley and Commander Riker.
Yeah. I was going to say, that is my favorite part of the episode, I think.
Yeah. Me, our fallen comrade Benjamin Yong, as well as guest Julia Dilworth, Julia could not for the life of her figure out why the three of us boys were laughing so hard at so much of this. She's just kind of rolling her eyes. But I think what we were trying to establish with them is, hey, is this an intriguing enough pilot that you'd want to continue on with this series? And I think their response was more like, meh, is a little muted.
Right.
This to me, like, I keep going back to, you know, whether this is the way to launch a new Star Trek series. This entire episode was supposed to be about Farpoint Station, and then Q is thrown in at the very end. The Q stuff, I think, is far more interesting than any of the Farpoint stuff.
Yeah, that's what I think, too. Like, everything to do with Q is actually really strong, and I do think it's a much more valuable episode for that reason, which is why I don't have it as, you know, my number 9 or 8.
Yeah, and that's all coming from Gene Roddenberry. That's all the stuff that he threw in there as opposed to what DC Fontana wrote, which was all the Farpoint stuff.
Right.
So, I can't... Tell me why this one isn't at necessarily your number 9 or your number 10.
To me, I just enjoyed more of the character moments, kind of the introduction to the characters.
Okay.
And
see where they started?
Exactly. Yeah. You know, because you really rewatch it, get an idea of where those characters ended up versus where they began.
Yeah.
And I just really enjoyed sort of seeing their intros and also just like moments throughout, you know, Data on the holodeck.
Sure.
Is fantastic, yeah. I think. There, you Whistling? Know, there's the first reference of Pinocchio.
Yeah.
And it just does a much better job than I'd remembered. Like, when I watched it originally, I remember being bored out of my mind. Revisiting it for the podcast, I looked at it a lot more with a lot more appreciation for how it did kind of put the pieces in place for these characters. Sure, it was a little rough and bumpy in places. And there is definitely some camp value to certain elements. You know, yes. Troy's final words and what have you. Great joy and whatever.
Well, which character, looking back on it, was like kind of the greatest shock to see? Like, just like how different that character is from where they ended up?
I mean, Picard is definitely a lot more of like kind of a jerk in that pilot. But we would see that through season 1 and 2 a fair deal. He was the biggest surprise, I think.
Okay. For me, I think maybe even Geordi. Like, Geordi was such, like, this outgoing kind of character who very much turned into kind of a grumpy guy.
Right.
So, it is fascinating. Here's the thing. Is this a slog to get through? I think at points, but there's enough stuff where it's more like kind of satiates my curiosity about certain things. And I still think that saucer sequence is kind of cool.
The Sasa Sepa?
Sasa Sepa.
Yeah. And I mean, I really like seeing Tasha Yar played very prominently in the episode, because that's something we would not see a lot of going forward, other than Code of Honor.
Well, it was so unfortunate that they built her up as like such a great character, and then they just kind of let it fizzle out as they did. There's a reason why we keep bringing her back throughout the run of Next Generation, and maybe throughout at least one of these two-parters as well.
Yeah, so let's get to my number 8, and that's Unification.
Oh, okay.
This is the episode where we get to see Spock come back. And it also involves Denise Crosby returning as Sela. And I have nothing wrong... Like, whereas when I look at Birthright and Gambit as premises for two-parters, I kind of roll my eyes and say, this does not even look like a two-parter on paper. Unification feels like it should be a two-parter. Yeah. And yet, why is it not more involving?
It's... I think the big problem here is the first part, it's building up to so much. And then we get to the second part, and you're like, oh, now it's Spock.
Yeah.
And you're like, wait, that's it? It's just like the whole plan with the Romulans was nonsense.
Right. And Sela, a character who is just like has so much potential. So, so much. Every time she's introduced in the show, you're like, oh, this character's going to go big places. I mean, she doesn't amount to that much more than the, Darth Sidious Sulaban from Enterprise.
And that was her swan song, essentially.
Yeah.
You know, and the other thing is, like, you've been building up with the Romulans throughout that entire season. You have Geordi, he's getting brainwashed. Sela, you know, makes that first kind of return there. And this is how it ends? The Romulans have a plan to put 3,000 troops on...
Embedded troops.
Embedded troops. Yeah, my apologies, Cam. Yeah, 3,000 troops on Vulcan, and they're going to take over the entire planet with 3,000 troops?
Yeah.
And they keep saying, but they're embedded.
Right, and they want Spock to give a speech, but then they're just going to use a hologram Spock anyway?
Yeah. So it's like...
It just sort of ends with, well, I guess she's under arrest. So long, Sela.
Yeah, there are some good moments in this. Like
there are definitely good moments. There's the opening in part one, the pairing of Data and Picard going on that mission with the Klingon, played by Steven Root. That stuff's great. Like, it's so much fun. Great character dynamics.
I love, you know, Data watching Picard sleep.
Yeah. We'll just leave it at that.
Yeah. No, Picard did not feel the same way, though. But it's just, like, good comedy bits, good character moments as well.
You have the death of Sarek. Yeah, which is really, really moving.
That's actually well done. One of the issues we had, though, with part one was the directing. That was Les Landau, I believe, who directed that one. And he's actually usually
pretty spot on.
Yeah, I think he's considered probably, like, director 1B, after David Carson, when it came to, like, their top directors for the series. So it was surprising, like, there's some bad directing choices in that episode. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if there's maybe time constraints. We also realized that part one was filmed after part two.
Yeah.
Just because of Leonard Nimoy's scheduling.
Right.
So fun stuff in part two, like the holographic Riker, who has really bad hair.
Right.
That's how we figured out he's a hologram.
It's funny, though, how few of these really fun moments we reference are actually related to the overall story.
I know.
You know, there's like the Worf doing the singing with the the keyboard player in that bar. Again, that's really related to the Romulan story.
But that sequence has lived on in infamy for this podcast.
It's great.
In that really sizable Ferengi eating a lot of food with those women,
and that scrap dealer.
Yeah. Oh, the quartermaster.
Yeah.
He was fantastic.
Loved him.
You know, but like, what does it really add up to by the end of it?
A really disappointing story that just doesn't feel like it was very fleshed out on the page, and they kind of just were like, well, it's all we got.
I do wonder if, you know, this is better regarded by fans, more well regarded by fans, just because it has Leonard Nimoy in it.
Yeah.
He's meeting up with Picard, that sort of stuff.
It does conclude the Sela arc.
Yeah.
Maybe not in a satisfying way in our judgment, but for others, maybe it is.
All right. Well, you know what? We went over my number 8 already. I put number 8 as Gambit.
Mm-hmm.
So to me, it wasn't at the top of my list. There's enough enjoyable elements in it that I could, you know, watch it again without it feeling like a real slog.
Right.
Number 7 for me, that was Unification. So we just discussed that. Why don't we go on to your number 7 then, Cam?
My number 7 was Redemption.
Okay.
Redemption is a two-parter that I want to love. The first time I watched it, it left almost no impression on me.
So really?
I was excited to rewatch it for this podcast. We watched it. We reviewed that one with Nick Eagland.
Yeah.
Twice, because the first recording disappeared into the other, and we had to record it again with him. So I've talked for 2 hours about Redemption. Tyler, why can I not remember almost anything about Redemption? It's like the two-parter out of any of the ones on my list that no matter how many times I watch it, it completely just disappears from my brain.
That surprises me because there's so much stuff that I can appreciate from it and I remember. First thing I should mention, though, is God bless Nick Eagland for coming over to my apartment 2 nights in a row to record podcast. I felt terrible.
He was a champion.
He was. But it's such a quintessential Worf story. I understand his motivation for everything. Mm-hmm. His motivation makes sense for everything. It also really fires up kind of this arc that we've been witnessing throughout the course of that season, in which there's like this brewing Klingon Civil War going. And
the Civil War that involves 3 men in a room.
Now, don't forget 2 ships.
Yeah. Yeah. The driving to the sun.
I actually like that. You know, you did not care for it. I thought it was okay. But
I love Gowron in this two-parter. Like, Robert O'Reilly is great. He's my favorite part of this. I just find it really strange. And it's like, I don't even have negative feelings towards Redemption, because that would imply I have feelings.
Sure.
It's just sort of there. When I look at my list of two-parters, I have like strong feelings one way or the other about all of them. Except Redemption.
Well, okay, so my issue here is that we're still in the era of Next Generation two-parters where it's very obvious and clear that they're not breaking both parts, the stories, all at the same time.
Right.
They're breaking part one, then they're taking off for the summer, and then they're breaking the story for part two.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just very clear that they set a lot of stuff up and they didn't know exactly how it was going to pay it off. But I mean, like, I think one of the best moments in all the two-parters is when they have that send-off for Worf leading down to the transporter room.
Right.
Tell me that's not a sequence that you don't remember. Yeah. I know it's hard for you to remember things from this one, but that one is...
Well, it's funny you mention that, because one of my biggest complaints about Gambit when we reviewed it was that there was no iconic moments in that entire episode, pretty much. This definitely has one in that moment with Worf. It is a fantastic one.
No. The most iconic moment in Gambit was, put down your phasers. Think peaceful thoughts.
Oh, yeah. That was great. Yeah.
I can tell. But... when you get to part two, I have far fewer memories of part two, and I think that's definitely the weaker element in this particular sequence or two-part episode. We've got some Duras sisters bringing in an illegitimate child of Duras, and
yeah.
It's just so clear, like, I didn't really care
right.
by that point. I don't know, it was a letdown, I can say. Part two is a letdown. That's why I don't have it further up on my list.
Right.
You know, if part two is stronger, I think it would... what don't I just say? Number six for me was Redemption.
Right.
So it would have been... It's in the middle, and I put it as a totally mid-tier two-part episode. Mm-hmm. So, Cam, what's your number six now?
My number six is Encounter at Farpoint.
Okay.
Again, like, I agree, it's very hit or miss. But I think there was enough hits in it that were really memorable to me that gave it the slight edge over Redemption.
Okay.
I might say the worst moments of Encounter at Farpoint are far worse than anything Redemption has to offer.
Yeah.
But there was enough there that I really, like, especially the second time through, took away a lot of Encounter at Farpoint that I remember and really, you know, enjoy or dislike. It all feels like a very memorable opening to me.
Okay.
And, you know, the introduction of Q, I think... also is actually what made me place it a lot higher, is because I feel that is such an important bookend with another two-parter, and it is handled so well, and John Delancey is so great that I could not place it lower down my list.
And I did have some debate before I placed Encounter at Farpoint at number 9, because John Delancey couldn't save the entire episode, even though I think he was so important, the introduction of that character is so important. I do find it curious, though, that didn't John Delancey tell us at a recent convention that Gene Roddenberry wanted him on for, like, 10 episodes a season?
Yeah.
Which I find kind of crazy.
That makes no sense to me whatsoever.
You know, but hey, I would have taken it. But do you think we would have gotten sick of Q with 10 appearances a season?
Yeah, okay. I definitely do. Especially if he was wearing that, like, Future War outfit or whatever.
Where he can suck drugs?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Well, okay, so we've gone through, you know, 10 through 6.
Why do we want to just recount them?
Yeah, I think that makes sense. I'll start number 10 for me, Birthright. Number 9, Encounter at Farpoint. Number 8, Gambit. Number 7, Unification. And number 6, Redemption. What about you, Cam?
So I'm at number 10, Gambit. Number 9, Birthright. Number 8, Unification. Number 7, Redemption. And number 6, Encounter at Farpoint.
So it seems as if our top 5 all contain the same episodes as do our bottom 5. So it's just kind of the matter of the order in which we go in. But why don't we start with me at number 5. I put that as Descent.
Okay.
This was an episode where you're like, okay, the writers just decide we're going to go back and do the Borg. Might as well. It's tough to live up to, you know, how legendary Best of Both Worlds has become. But I do like the idea of, you know, lore becoming a part of that particular mm-hmm. world there, and just the impact that it has on Data as well, and as he's getting these emotions that he can't control. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of interesting elements here. Part two, I think, is actually pretty strong, and that's one of the issues that we have with a lot of these episodes is, you know, maybe part one starts off strong, number two, not so much, but I love the Beverly Crusher sequence where she's in charge of the ship with, like, this crew of, you know, kind of the losers, I suppose, you know. So there's enough going on here. I wouldn't put this as a top-tier, you know, two-part episode of Next Generation, but there's enough going on here that I don't mind putting in my top half.
Mm-hmm.
What about you, Cam? What do you think of Descent?
I placed it higher on my list.
Did you?
But it's one that when we went to rewatch it, I actually thought it would wind up low on my list.
Okay.
Like, my memories of Descent were not particularly fond. Like, they weren't bad. They were just kind of like, oh, I recall that being kind of a nothing.
Yeah.
Nothing event when I watched it, but I enjoyed it a lot more. And I think it really pays off the Data and lore story in an interesting way. I think the biggest criticism you could take against it is the kind of where it ends with the Borg.
Well, with
the Borg aren't exactly too threatening by the end of Descent.
Oh, wait until you... Well, you've gotten to the end of Voyager at this point. I'm there. How threatening are the Borg now?
Oh, not at all.
Yeah, okay. Well...
Icheb did not do them wonders.
But I do appreciate the fact that, you know, we have Hugh coming back. Mm-hmm. He's able to exert his influence to a certain degree. He can't really figure out that he's supposed to be the leader. He literally needs Picard to tell him that at the end of the episode.
Right.
But there's other just cool stuff going on throughout. I love the Brig sequence between Data and that drone, that individual drone,
mm-hmm.
and just how that guy's trying to tempt him.
Right, you yeah. know? To me, this episode, this two-parter is so consistent. Like, we, you know, have definitely... in all our review episodes, hammered on so many of these for not being consistent from part one to part two. Descent feels like a story where they actually had a story they wanted to tell, as opposed to, okay, I got an idea for part one, what do you want to do for part two?
Well, we'll take the summer off and figure it out when we get back.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Descent does not feel like that, even if that was the case. Maybe it was.
Yeah.
But there's a rich story there with lore, and I think kind of a tragic ending to that character.
Yeah, and props to Brent Spiner for spending the whole summer working out so that Lore could be featured with an 8-pack throughout all of part two.
Sacrifices he
not
made.
Not even a 6-pack, an 8-pack.
That's right.
You go.
That's right.
Okay, well, Cam, what's your number 5 then?
Well, young man, I put time 0 at number 5.
Wow, you do a great Guinan impersonation.
Why, thank you.
Cam, should we just do the entire review of Time 0 in this voice?
We've had requests for that.
Well, let's see how long we can make this last, Cameron.
I think people would be quickly turning the podcast off if we did that.
Why, Cameron?
So yes, Time 0 at number 5. This is, I think, a really fun two-parter.
I think this is the funnest two-parter that Next Gen ever did.
Yes, I agree, and it's one that I enjoyed, like a couple of the others, much more on the rewatch.
Yeah.
I recall enjoying it the first time, but the second time, maybe it was because I watched it with you and Tony Galush reviewed that episode with us, and it just felt like a lot more fun to watch in a group. Watch it by myself, well, it's like watching any comedy by yourself.
Sure.
You kind of lose a lot. You're like, well, that was fine, I didn't laugh once, because I was in an empty room by myself, depressed, alone. Yeah. Lights off. But whereas watching it this time, there was just, I don't know, it felt more energetic. I enjoyed more of sort of the fish out of water stuff. I mean, fish out of water and Star Trek goes together brilliantly almost every time. Even like in an episode like, was it Yesterday's Tomorrow or whatever, the very confusingly titled TOS season 1 episode where they go back to like the 60s. That episode is, again, not a great episode, but like the fish out of water stuff is really fun to see. It's fun to see in an even better episode here.
And it's so clear that I think this is one of the first episodes that we realized that the writers were clearly breaking the story in advance.
Yeah.
In parts 1 and 2, because they had a beginning. They had actually set up a lot of stuff in part 1 that wasn't paid off until part 2. And that's something that you didn't really see in the previous two-parters.
Yeah.
And the thing is, I think you bring up a good point, like just your first watch of it versus, you know, our most recent watch of it. When I was a kid, I thought this episode was okay. Like, to me, I honestly thought it was a bit of a letdown for like a season finale.
Right.
I was hoping for more after, you know, we had stuff like Redemption, which I liked quite a bit as a kid.
Right.
Then I watched this, I'm just like, oh, going back in time to, like, to me, like, 1880s San Francisco didn't really mean that much to me.
Yeah.
This is, watching it as an adult, this is a fun episode, it's well written, and, like, I think Star Trek, a bit of a mixed track record when it comes to comedy.
Especially in TNG.
Especially TNG.
It's just because of the tone of TNG is a little bit heavier and a little more solemn than, say, the original series.
But here, I mean, I thought
it works like Gangbusters. Yeah. There's that opening bit with like Data playing poker, and just, you know, the payoff to that is just him just walking into a room with like a feathered hat. Like, it's just brilliant visual comedy. It's very character based in how, you know, Data would react in that environment, and that goes throughout. Like, I, you know, the Picard theater troupe. You know, again, that's something that is so broad and goofy that it could have just been played really badly.
But, he had
but it totally works.
Great cranky landlord who kept trying to collect her money, her rent.
And like the chase on the wagons.
And... Well, let me ask you this, though. Let's get back to Samuel Clemens, Cameron.
Okay, then.
Was he the biggest problem you had with this episode?
Well, at least he's memorable, though. The thing is, like, Samuel Clemens, played by Jerry Harden, is definitely a polarizing figure, at least with us, when we did this episode, in that he feels far more like a caricature than an actual character.
He doesn't seem as if he belongs in this universe.
No, he's definitely far more alien than any alien on Star Trek. Including that four-armed keyboard player in Unification. he's definitely really goofy and broad. But he's memorable, and he's become strangely iconic. So
is he well loved among the average fans?
He is, I think.
I can't stand him. Like, I really like. I find him just grating.
And I said this in the episode when we reviewed it, but I really enjoy him a lot more when he's on board the Enterprise, talking just with Deanna Troi about the future and about the sort of how humans behave.
Okay, but then it also just shows to me how much he does not fit in with this universe because like he's just walking around talking like this, and it's just like, why, dude? Like that's not this universe at all.
The scene that I can't stand is the scene at the party where he gives like this like 3-minute monologue and it's just like this old windbag just wheezing going around in circles. And everyone is standing at rapt attention. And here's the thing, like Samuel Clemens, we all know, was a brilliant, brilliant, you know, writer and man. And so the idea that, you know, he would hold court at a party, I completely believe.
Yeah.
However, this version of Samuel Clemens would be someone you would not want to have at your party.
No. One of my favorite things ever was like this YouTube video made of Samuel Clemens digging throughout Data's room looking for like evidence of technology.
Yeah.
And all it did is took out everything except for his grunts and it just inserted his, his like,
It's like becoming Yoda.
Yeah. It was quite fantastic there. What did you think of Guinan in this episode?
I really enjoyed her discussions with Data.
Yeah.
I'm not a big fan, and, you know, we talked about this, of, like, the whole sequence of, like, the aliens in the caves and the shooting the phasers and all that sort of stuff is a little...
The snake.
It's just not staged that well.
I think that snake staff is really... I don't know what they were thinking there, but...
It's a little strange, yeah. Like, a lot of the kind of the wraparound stuff doesn't wow me. But enough of it is... Actually, though, there is that great moment where Data's just describing what he sees.
Yeah.
That's fantastic. Just so well directed, that sequence. But, you know, kind of the conceit that gets me to the time travel isn't as interesting to me as the time travel stuff.
Sure.
But there's enough time travel spread out over this two-parter to, I think, justify it and makes it a lot of fun.
Yeah. Cam, why don't we go on to your number four now?
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's where I put Descent. Descent was an episode that, again, as I said, like... didn't have super strong feelings about going in, but really left with a real appreciation for Brent Spiner's performance and just what it means for Data and Lore. And Lore is a villain who, it's funny, he's a character that I feel like should be far more iconic within TNG as a major villain. He's definitely popular and fans love him and so on and so forth, but he doesn't feel like... When people talk about the great TNG villains, they'll talk about, you know, Q, for example. You don't hear Lore necessarily held up as one of the greats. He's definitely up there with, like, a Sela, as someone who's iconic and, you know, recurs throughout the series. But I feel like Lore, especially when you watch this episode, should have been, like, an all-timer Trek villain.
Do you think it maybe hurt the character a little bit that he only appeared in a total of, like, 3 or 4 episodes?
Yeah.
I think there's so much more potential for him to, I don't know, make one appearance a season, you know?
Yeah, I mean, why not? If you can get a Q episode every season, basically, you know, why not have a Lore? Especially, like, you know, Data Lore is, like, one of the best episodes of season one.
Yeah.
Not a strong season, obviously, but Data Lore definitely stands out.
But I still think that you could put that episode in, like, say, season three, and it's still, like, a good episode for even in a strong season like that, you know?
Yeah, and, you know, the whole series about Data's search to understand, you know, human emotions, there's so much more to explore there with Lore.
Yeah, and there's all this untapped potential with that character, so it's kind of disappointed that... The next closest thing we got was B4.
Yeah.
you know.
Yeah, but I mean, if you're gonna have a send-off for Lore, this is, I think, a fantastic one.
Yeah.
And you compare this as a, you know, two-part send-off to what Sela got, it's light years ahead.
Okay, well, my number four could be a bit of a controversial pick. I'm actually going with Best of Both Worlds. It might seem a little bit low down on the list for some people, but I think it has a fantastic first part. One of my favorite William Riker episodes of all time, part one. I just think, like, part two is just such a letdown. You know, it just, like, the story, if we keep asking ourselves, can the story, you know, justify itself over two parts? I think there's no reason why this could not have, but it was so clear that they were just kind of making it up as they went along.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there was the potential for them to have lived up to the greatness that was part one. And they didn't manage to capitalize on that.
Yeah, this was my number three.
Was that?
So we're pretty close to you. Yeah, I agree. Part one is an all-timer episode. The introduction of Shelby is fantastic. Elizabeth Dennehy is just so great as this character. The whole Picard getting kidnapped and introduced as Locutus. Sensational stuff. You have the sequence where they find, you know, go to the sort of the aftermath of Wolf 359. And it's just this haunting image of them going through this, you know, desiccated just field of destruction. And it's so haunting and eerie. And you compare it to, like, that sort of ship graveyard sequence from the 2009 Star Trek. And this is one of the few cases where the TV show does it better than the movie with a huge budget.
I definitely think a lot of that had to do with pacing.
Mm-hmm.
You really, like, felt like as if you were in that sequence for a long period of time. And there wasn't really anything that we had seen like that on Star Trek before.
No.
You know? And so, to that end, let's bring up Shelby as well, because I think it's just one of those what-could-have-been situations. Like, mm-hmm. why... The writers must have known she was a fantastic character. All the interviews I see with her, she seems to be, like, a very wonderful person to be around. Why did they never bring her back? Like, that's just baffling to me.
It is a complete head-scratcher to me as well. You know, we just talked about Lore. Why Lore wasn't used much. Maybe because it was just complicated to have, you know, Brent Spiner playing two roles all the time.
Sure.
But there's no excuse to not bring back Shelby. Those complications do not exist. This is a character who, you know, nowadays, if she'd been introduced, say even on Enterprise, she would have shown up more.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't mind it if, like, we saw her popping up as captain of her own ship. Mm-hmm. You know, that sort of thing. You know, there's just so much untapped potential there, which is disappointing. You know, even if she popped up on Deep Space Nine or something, like, that would have been great. Okay.
Yeah, that is a real bummer. And for me, yeah, I mean, I'll just say, as it was my number three, I mean, again, why most fans hold this up as sort of the greatest two-parter of all time. It's definitely hugely popular, instantly iconic. But as well, I agree, part two is not as satisfying.
I like how the momentum and the greatness of part one can elevate it so high up on this list that more so than I think it possibly deserves to be, mm-hmm. you know, because part two as a standalone is just kind of like, that's okay.
Right.
You know?
Like, yeah, going from, you know, that great, great dramatic build-up to Riker saying fire, you're like, this is top tier, you know, TNG. This is everything this series could be, considering, you know, the seasons that preceded it were a little rocky. This was kind of TNG really throwing down the book and saying, this is what TNG is going to be. And then you get to the, you know, start of season four and the payoff to it all, and it's like, well, okay.
I'll tell you what the sin is, and it's also a sin that Michael Piller committed against his own sort of writing mandate, which is part two is very much story-oriented.
Yeah.
It's not really a character-oriented episode, whereas part one is very much a character-oriented episode that is highlighted by so many great sequences.
Mm-hmm.
So when you get to part two and it's just like, okay, we've got to wrap up the story, let's just make the characters do this for story purposes. Like, what essentially is part two about? Like... I could say part one is really about, like, William Riker's existential crisis and mm-hmm. career. I don't know what's part two about.
Saving Picard and then turning him back into Picard.
But that's all story oriented.
Yes, yes. It's people throwing out exposition, explaining how they're going to do it. the character of Locutus is so badass in part one that when you get to part two and his threat is completely removed, he becomes this weird comedic figure where he's like walking around the bridge being like, I'm going to assimilate you to Worf. And the threat is gone, especially, I mean, and this is no fault of Patrick Stewart, he's not a physically imposing man, which is why I think Picard was written as a very different character than, say, Sisko or Kirk. But the idea of him kind of wandering around a bridge in Borg makeup threatening Worf is kind of laughable.
Well, he is effectively neutered by the time he's literally naked in the science lab.
Yeah.
It's just like, this guy's no threat anymore.
Yeah.
So, you know, but look, without part two, we would not have gotten Family, which is one of my all-time favorite episodes of Next Generation. That's a character-oriented episode. And you know, without that build-up that we got from, you know, parts one and two, we would never have gotten Family, so.
Or First Contact.
Yeah, exactly.
So, like, great things came out of Best of Both Worlds, which is why I think it's so important.
Yeah.
And why I hold it so high up. But it is frustrating. It's frustrating because it's come so close to touching greatness that it just falls a little bit short.
Yeah, I know there's going to be listeners who are like, what are these guys talking about? It's the best episode ever. But I just really urge you to go back and just watch part two on its own.
Yeah.
And just ask yourself if that really is like a great episode. Mm-hmm. I think it's a pretty good episode.
There's good stuff throughout.
Yeah.
Like, this is not a case of, like, say, like Birthright, where part two, you're kind of like, what am I watching?
Hoops. Spears and hoops.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, well, why don't we go on to the next one, Cam? Well, you know, we've covered it already, but I think Time's Arrow deserves a stronger mention here.
Number three. Over Best of Both Worlds.
Over Best of Both Worlds, because here's what I mentioned before. This is the first time that it was very apparent that the writers had broken the story for parts one and two simultaneously.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is so much more of a cohesive episode than Best of Both Worlds. It's character-based as well. There's some fun story elements. I think if our whole thesis here is you need to justify yourself as a two-part episode, I think that Time's Arrow acquits itself of that more so than Best of Both Worlds does. Do I think Best of Both Worlds Part 1 is an inferior episode to, say, Time's Arrow Parts 1 or 2? No, I think Best of Both Worlds Part 1 is a superior episode, but that's just Part 1. I have to take them all as one singular thing, and I think that Time's Arrow is a superior two-parter, essentially. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, and it's, you know, Time's Arrow definitely had more of an uphill battle to fight compared to most of these to justify being 2 hours. Because something that's very lightly comedic, the idea of it being, you know, 2 hours, 2 television hours long, you really have to maintain the sort of strong, you know, that fast kind of comedic pace, the energy. And it could have easily died a brutal death.
Yes.
And so, if the comedy doesn't work and it's 2 hours long.
Oh, gosh.
Like, can you imagine if, say, Profit and Lace was 2 hours?
I can't even imagine if it was 20 minutes.
Or the cost of living.
Dear Lord.
Like, it would be absolute torture.
What do you think it was that, like, I don't know, because you need to be confident that you can pull this off over two parts. Mm-hmm. Do you think it was just the fact that they had broken the story simultaneously and then they figured, hey, we know these actors well enough. We know that they can do what they can't do. And I think there's a reason why such a strong entry and a comedic episode came so late in the game for Next Generation.
It also helps that I'm sure they'd invest a certain amount in production value.
Oh, yeah.
Using that whole backlot set that they wanted to spread it out over 2 hours to kind of get the most of it, because they say they wanted to use it more throughout the season.
Yeah, that quote from Ron Moore never really made sense to me.
That's bizarre. Like, I would love the whole season in old-timey San Francisco.
I hope what he really meant was that they wanted Samuel L. Clemens to, you know, become like a junior crew member aboard the ship.
Bam, me up!
Well, you know, like Chief O'Brien was leaving later that season, so that he needed a replacement. Yeah.
Sure.
So there
that
you
would have been pretty amazing.
Well, Cam, let's go on to your number three then.
My number two.
Oh, that's right. Your number three, of course, was Best of Both Worlds.
That's
right. We covered that. So your number two
is All Good Things.
Is it? Okay.
Yeah, All Good Things, as we recently, fairly recently talked about with guest Tony Galush, is, I think, one of the greatest series finales of all time.
It's tough to sometimes stick the landing when it comes to, like, a great television series. And for them to actually, like, actually knock it out of the ballpark here.
Yeah.
Props to them. It's fantastic.
And they did not go small, like, say, the Cheers finale, where it's just about them, you know, having a drink in the bar. Like, this is a wildly ambitious final 2 hours.
Hey, I do want to defend the Cheers finale for a little bit. There was that extended sequence where Sam and Diane are on the airplane, and yeah. Sam's debating whether to go take off with Diane. And I remember as a kid watching it going, like, just get on with it. Like, this is way too long. There's only, like, 13 minutes left yeah. in all of Cheers, and we're on an airplane. I didn't have any of that in All Good Things.
It's funny you mention that. I've had that anxiety in so many series finales.
Yes.
I remember feeling the same way in Breaking Bad. Okay. Like, time's running out. Like, what's going to happen?
Like, oh no. They're spending time with laser pointers pointed at right. at Elliot and Gretchen.
Exactly. You know, so many series finales, especially nowadays, are culminations of a story. They really are almost like epilogues.
Yeah.
This is not. This is like, we're just going to come up with a wild, like, you know, finale to the series that really is not continued off of anything.
And I think, you know, part of the fact is, like, the writers, Brandon Braga and Ron Moore, they're under the gun. There's a big time constraints here. I think they only had maybe 1 month to write it, mm-hmm. Which is not a long period of time for an hour and a half endeavor.
Right.
Which they had spent, what, I think almost a year writing Generations
right.
at the same time. Props to them for pulling this off. And this is just such a, like, there's so many amazing character moments. I remember watching it as a kid, like, being able to kind of imagine how the characters ended up in the future.
Mm-hmm.
Just this rift between Worf and Riker was amazing. I love being able to go back in time to, like, even like the events right before Encounter at Farpoint. Be like, oh yeah, it's Tasha. Mm-hmm. Hey, look, it's Colm Meaney fitting ever so well into that very, very tight jumpsuit.
Right, yeah. You
know, like, just those little things. And think about Data, like, when he first appeared and he didn't know what burning the midnight oil meant.
Right, and it's so poignant to see, you know, where we came from and, you know, ultimately where it could go.
Yeah.
When you see all of those characters older, we see grouchy old Admiral Riker. Oh, it's just, and obviously there's, you know, all sort of the fallout of the Troy and Worf relationship. It's paying off little seeds of moments that were throughout season 7. I just think this is just a sensational 2 hours of television and so ambitiously conceived that even for, you know, whatever year this was, 1993?
94.
That's frankly astonishing to me. This is 94 television.
Just production values.
Yes.
Yes.
And just the amount of effort they went to for a finale.
What other series airing in 1994 do you recall having production values such as this finale?
I mean, The X-Files had very strong production values, but I mean, I wouldn't even
yeah,
say...
Yeah, but like season 2 X-Files?
It was pretty strong.
Yeah, I would put this on a level above maybe the average episode of The X-Files.
They also spent much bigger for this finale than The yeah. X-Files could afford.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
But not just in terms of, like, production value, just the ambition of the script, tying all these timelines together, and it never feels messy. There are so many movies I see nowadays that could take lessons from how to put together, you know, a time travel sort of alternate dimension storyline from this two-parter. I think it's just sensational storytelling.
Yeah, Ron Moore and Brandon Braga really should have watched this episode before writing Star Trek Generations.
What the hell happened?
Yeah, but hey, I think it's great that we ended up getting the series finale as All Good Things as opposed to Generations as a series finale.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Or Nemesis.
No.
You know, Nemesis didn't exactly send those characters off that well either.
What does indefinite mean?
Click.
Well, let's bring up John DeLancey again, though. How lucky are we that we have this Q character? You mentioned him earlier on as kind of this bookend. I think, you know, this would have been still a really solid episode without Q, but I think he really provides, like, kind of this closed loop, you mm-hmm. know, to a certain degree. And I just love the fact how Q's like, John Luke, this trial never ends. Mm-hmm. You know, humanity will always be on trial.
Yeah.
You're going to have to keep reaching for those stars, bucko.
Not only is John DeLancey absolutely fantastic in this episode, this might be his best performance as
yeah.
Q. And it's rare you see that for recurring guest characters showing up for their, like, what, 7th or 8th time at this point. And he is astonishing. I think it's a crime that he never got, like, an Emmy nomination.
Well,
I mean, no one did. That's the, you know, none of the actors got nominations.
No.
But John DeLancey, let's just go on a little rant about the Emmys here. I mean, look at the legacy of Star Trek Next Generation. Look how beloved that show is and how those stories have touched people over the last 30 years. It's coming up on its 30th anniversary. Not a single Emmy nomination for acting.
Yeah.
That is embarrassing.
But there's so many other series that very embarrassing that they did not get Emmy nominations as well. With any award show, I can't take them too seriously.
I know.
The Academy Awards or what have you, I'm just like, well, them's the breaks.
Right.
But I agree. They did get an Emmy nomination for Best Series, and that was the one and only year that they did. This is for season 7, so there you go.
One of the weakest seasons of TNG. Yeah.
But that's why, like, the Emmys are so just, like, eye roll.
It was kind of a, we're late to the party, here's a nomination.
Yeah, which is very common as well. Yeah. So
I just always think it's very kind of amusing, and it's not just reserved for Star Trek, how these performances that will touch an entire generation of people and beyond, influence, students of theater going forward into the next generation of acting, are ignored.
Yeah.
It's kind of like, oh, yeah, that was fine,
Well, Cam, so I actually placed All Good Things as my number one.
Right.
I just think it's such a fantastic way to wrap the series, and I couldn't have asked for more. Because we'll go and be touching on other series finales, and there's ones that I can say, oh, that was good, or,
Can you?
There's maybe one I can say, but, like, for whatever reason, this one has just a certain lightning-in-a-bottle quality that I didn't find with the other series finales, no matter how, good they were, so to speak. So why don't we go on to my number two? It has to be, if my math is correct, your number one episode.
Right.
Chain of Commands.
Correct.
This just tete-a-tete between, the spiritual battle between Picard and Gulmatred. Just one of the finest acting sequences we've ever seen put to screen for Star Trek.
Complemented by the battle between Riker and Jellicoe, played by Ronnie Cox, which is equally strong. This is one where you could, the B story isn't just kind of there. It is as compelling as the central one. Like, the Riker-Jellicoe battle could be a whole episode unto itself. So you have two fantastic episodes smashed together and just playing off each other thematically. And I think this is just a total masterpiece. This is a showcase for Star Trek acting.
And you definitely get the feeling sometimes if there's a fan favorite episode or just a really strong episode, sometimes, it's almost by accident. Like, the writers don't even realize it at the time. They had no idea that The Visitor would be so well received.
Right.
They actually thought that yesterday's Enterprise was going to turn into a real crappy episode.
They didn't think that, like, 30 years later, Quentin Tarantino would be fawning over it on a podcast.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But with Chain of Command, I think it's so obvious that the writers, they're like, look, we know what we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
We have a lot to go through. We're going to set all this up. We're going to have kind of this spiritual battle, not only between Picard and Madred, but between Riker and Jellicoe.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, like, sometimes you can swing and miss. They swing and they hit it out of the ballpark.
Yeah.
This is so great. This is a very well-directed episode. Mm-hmm. When Riker is dismissed as first officer, all you do is they cut to a sequence in which Data is wearing a red uniform.
Right.
You don't need to know anything else after that. It's just like brilliance like that. And I don't know. This is just one of my... It's definitely an episode that I think you can recommend to non-Star Trek fans. And they're going to walk away with it and say, okay, I get it, guys. Mm-hmm. This is why you watch it. I can appreciate it now.
Right. I mean, sometimes Star Trek acting can be a little bit awkward. Especially if it's a poorly written episode, you'll sit there and be like, oh, this is kind of brutal to watch. This is what happens. This is why they stuck with that type of acting, because when they nail a story like this, it is just fireworks.
And I mean, how lucky are they? They got not only David Warner, but they had Ronnie Cox perfectly cast.
Ronnie Cox, very underrated. Like, obviously David Warner walked away with the share of the kudos for this two-parter. But Ronnie Cox is absolutely fantastic.
I think the reason he doesn't get maybe the respect that we both think he's due is because the character's...
not flashy.
He's not flashy.
Yeah.
It really seems like a guy you'd see in an episode of Matlock or something.
And he feels like someone that in real life would be like your boss and you would very much dislike him. So no one wants to see that character on TV. kind of picking on their favorite characters.
Yeah, but it's such... And the thing is, it's not like Ronnie Cox is, like, blowing it up at the Star Trek conventions where, you know, there's huge lineups to, you know, get your photo with him. It's a great character, but it's not necessarily the most likable character. Those mm-hmm. things are not mutually exclusive. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I definitely think... Just what a showcase episode for TNG. And I think the writers knew it at the time. And I think it's very clear that they thought a lot about it going into it. The interesting thing is, and we brought this up when we reviewed it, but like I always remember this episode as 2 hours of Picard getting interrogated.
Right.
And then we realized like Madred really only shows up in like part two. Mm-hmm. And that's when the interrogation, you know, five lights versus four lights mm-hmm. is going on. But that whole Captain Jellicoe stuff is there right from the get-go.
Right.
So.
And there's ambiguity to this episode, too. The idea of, you know, how close was Picard to breaking?
Yeah.
You know, how close was Madred to being victorious? And then also just this great study of how mundane evil can be. Where, you know, he's bringing his child out to see Picard, you know, being tortured, essentially. And just dynamite stuff that TNG, you know, we talked about this when we reviewed it, too, is that or TNG and Star Trek as a whole don't like to kind of plunge themselves into the darkness too much. But when they did it incredibly well. And this episode is maybe the greatest example of it.
Yeah. You know, I think you bring up the fact that we've got Golmadred, mm-hmm. kind of how mundane evil can be. But what about how mundane, like almost a jerky boss can be?
Yeah.
You know, like he's a great antagonist, maybe not as well... He's even a tier below the lower Sela level when it comes to like their how well regarded they are among fans.
Yeah,
which is unfortunate. But he just seems like this kind of mundane dude that you would never expect to see in a Starfleet uniform. You'd expect him, you know, to be wearing like a pocket protector or something at the workplace. You know,
or working like under O'Brien on DS9 or something.
I guess the reason why he sticks out to us though, I think though, is because you look at Star Trek: The Next Generation. And you see all these characters, and they don't always necessarily reflect, you know, people in real life. But I really think that Jellicoe touches a nerve because he seems so much like a real-life person you'd encounter in the 20th to 21st century.
Yes, very much so. That micromanager kind of almost like just loser, but a loser who's managed to gain power.
But the thing is, he is a captain for a reason.
And he's shown to be somewhat efficient.
Yeah.
His methods are kind of unbearable. But he's somewhat efficient.
I think we both agreed that the crew of the USS Cairo must have been cheering when he left, though. This is not a captain you'd ever want to serve under, is
it? How great would a series be about the USS Cairo under Jellicoe?
Oh, God.
would it be like The Office?
I would like to see the adventures of then-Captain Pressman and his first officer, Commander Jellicoe.
So good.
Yeah.
That would be amazing.
Good number one pick. I think you'd agree my number one pick. Not too shabby either.
Can't complain about it.
Okay.
So why don't we just recap our top tens for everyone at home.
Go first.
Okay. So my number 10 was Gambit. Number 9, Birthright. Number 8, Unification. Number 7, Redemption. Number 6, Encounter at Farpoint. Number 5, Time Zero. Number 4, Descent. Number 3, Best of Both Worlds. Number 2, All Good Things. And number 1, Chain of Command.
Well, my number 10 is Birthright. My number 9 is Encounter at Farpoint. My number 8 is Gambit. 7, Unification.
Polymata Cracker.
I can't keep it up. Number 6, Redemption. Number 5, Descent. Number 4, Best of Both Worlds. Number 3, Time Zero. Number 2, Chain of Command. Number 1, All Good Things.
Okay, so we've kind of got... We did a whole episode in the past for the movies that was kind of like an award show with various categories.
Two episodes, did we not?
Well, we did one about ranking and then a whole episode of kind of awards.
Yeah.
We don't really have enough awards to give for the two-parters. They're not cinematic, so you don't have the same sort of categories you would have for movies. But we thought it would be...
It's not cinematic like Star Trek Insurrection was cinematic.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. So we've kind of got, though, a handful of awards we'll kind of give out now here at the tail end.
Yeah.
So Tyler, I'm curious, what do you think was the best performance in a TNG two-parter?
That's... Okay. I know it sounds like such a... cliche answer, like an obvious answer, but I think Patrick Stewart in Chain of Command.
That was mine too.
It's memorable for a reason, though.
No Emmy nomination,
but I mean, and I think Patrick Stewart said, you know, like this is probably one of the best performances he's ever done, you know, like that's been caught on screen. Mm-hmm. So I look, no, not too many arguments from anybody, right?
Yeah, I mean, when you look at the greatest performances he gave on TNG, you're going to say, you know, probably The Inner Light, maybe Family.
Yeah.
But I feel like this is the one where you see him kind of like the rawest and the most like emotionally exposed.
And I don't know if this, he would have gone there without such a great, you know, partner like David Warner.
Mm-hmm.
You know, another British actor known for his stage presence as well. And exactly, he trusts him. Like, he could go there with that. And they really, really went to dark places. And man, it pays off.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Cam, what about a best guest star performance?
I really struggled with this one because there's some great ones. Yeah. I had Elizabeth Dennehy as Shelby was on my list, as well as John DeLancey for All Good Things.
Right.
I think I'm going to go with David Warner as Gal Madrid.
Okay.
Because John DeLancey is the second place for me. He's so close.
Yeah.
But the reason I went with David Warner is because of just how hateful this character is, how much of an impact he leaves on me. He makes me uncomfortable to watch in a way that no other, I don't think, Star Trek villain ever does. Usually they're a little poppier, a little more fun. Like, Khan is fun.
I think Chang's fun.
Chang is fun, sure. The Borg Queen is fun.
Yeah.
There's nothing fun about Gal Madrid. And he brings something out of the characters that I don't think any other Star Trek villain does, including an antagonist like Q.
Yeah.
And David Warner, I mean, thank God they brought him back, because, you know, thankfully Star Trek V was not his only, you know, shot at the...
Not St. John Talbot?
Yeah. My God. Like, well, he just finally, you know, got to really swing and just hit a home run with this character. And it kind of almost... I don't know. How do you feel about the fact we never got to see Gal Madrid again?
It's another one of those what could have been sort of situations.
Are we better off, though?
I think so, because then, like, when he does return, you're like, oh, well, he's not nearly as, you know, fascinating as I found him in that amazing two-parter.
Mm-hmm.
But then, I don't know, you do bring back a lot of great characters in Deep Space Nine, and, like, I think Dukat gets, you know, more interesting as the series progresses.
Hmm.
Maybe not so much with the Paw Wraith, you know.
Right, Strange Bedfellows.
Oh, that's where he picks up again,
yeah.
In more ways than one.
Yeah.
For me, a best guest star, and this is... going back to, and I alluded to it earlier, but Elizabeth Dennehy, I keep saying, like, what could have been? Like,
mm-hmm.
I think the character worked so well. She had such clear chemistry with Jonathan Frakes there. If we had, you know, that whole thing where Patrick Stewart didn't return to Next Generation, you could have plugged her in as the new number one. It would have worked fantastically mm-hmm. well, you know? And just props to her, like, I keep thinking, like, oh, dang. Like, okay, we're okay with Madrid not coming back. I'm not okay with the fact that Shelby never came back, though.
Right.
You know, so that tells you something about her performance. Like, it really stood out to me.
Right. Let's move on to the worst guest star. This was tough. Yeah. I ended up going with Tok, played by Sterling Mason Jr. from Birthright Part 2. Somehow, Tok manages to be less likable than Alexander. Alexander is so doofy looking, especially when you get to, like, Fistful of Data so that I can laugh at him.
Sure.
Tok is just, he's just awful on every conceivable level. My runners-up were Richard Lynch as Baron, the villain of Gambit, as well as a character I think you might be about to mention now.
Okay. Well, I'm going to mention as worst guest actor one... Karen Hensel, who played Admiral Brackett in Unification Part 1.
That's the one.
Cam, you and I, we actually thought that she was, like, I don't know, like a fan off the street who was given, like, a bit part as part of a contest or something.
Yeah.
Until you looked it up and found out that she was actually a professional actress.
Yes.
She, like, her eye lines were so off. We had no idea what was going on. Her reading was so stilted. I think we had to chalk it up to just really bad direction from Wes Landau.
That episode often feels like it's blind characters.
Yeah.
Their eye lines aren't matching. Like, Stephen Root, who's, we know, a great actor, is having similar issues in that episode. So I don't really know what was going on there, but she's definitely like a fish out of water.
Her line readings are just, like, awful. Like, mm-hmm. I don't know what's going on there for a professional actress, so...
We had a good laugh about it, though, when we watched that episode.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, we laughed very hard.
How much did they cut down her scenes?
I'm only hoping for more to come out of the vault in years to come.
So. We can only hope. We're getting that vault series for for the original series. Hopefully we get TNG Vault for Unification Part 1.
Yeah. Well, Cam, what's the next category here?
The best action sequence. So what was yours?
I went with the phaser fight in Descent Part 1.
I went with that tied to the Data choking the Borg.
You got to pick one, Cameron.
Well, I'll take the Data choking the Borg sequence then.
Just because the kind of the acting.
The acting, but also what it means for Data. There's real tension to that sequence. And there's some horror to it because, you know, when we talked in our episode Starfleet versus Superpowered Beings about a year ago, just over a year ago, we talked about like what could happen if Data went wrong. Like what happens if Data doesn't wind up with the Federation, he winds up with like the Dominion or, you know, sort of a force that's a lot more negative. This sort of gives you a hint at what Data's capable of in the wrong, you know, gone awry.
For me, the reason I'm going with the phaser fight, though, is, look, we've seen some cool, you know, ship battle sequences mm-hmm. before. We've never actually seen a phaser fight done well in Star Trek prior to this.
They're pretty bad.
Yeah, this is the first time they actually did one, like, well, and it was actually done very well.
There's that one at the start of Gambit where they're, like, fighting over a pot, and it's just so brutal.
Yeah.
Well, okay, well, speaking of that battle over the pot, let's get to worst action sequences. Why don't you start?
Mine was the carriage chase in Time's Arrow.
That's so comedic, though, that I don't know. Like, I can't hate it that much.
It wasn't great action, though. No, like, it was funny. I laughed at it. But like, if I'm thinking of an exciting action sequence, the carriage chase with the whistles blowing, it's not going to make my list.
Sure. For me, I, you know, it's easy to pick on the ones that are just staged badly, like that battle over the pot in the woods or whatever, in Gambit. But I ended up going with one that I think really kind of hurts an episode, and that is in Best of Both Worlds Part 2. You have Worf grabbing Picard as Locutus.
Right.
And, you know, we've seen Locutus on that view screen. We've seen him kind of looking out through the Borg window on the cube, watching things be destroyed. There's a real, like, sense of presence and just terror to this character of Locutus. And then we cut to, like, giant Michael Dorn just, like, throwing around little Patrick Stewart. And it just kills the effect of Locutus.
I can't really argue with that.
Yeah.
Myself.
So, finally, I think we may be giving this award to the same thing, possibly, but it's the Why Is It a Two-Parter Award?
To me, there's no question about it. I think Birthright, to me, is the worst, you know, offender when it comes to stretching out a one-part episode over two parts. I don't even think this is a particularly strong one-part episode, like, you know, even if you condensed it.
Maybe, what about the DS9 stuff, though?
Yeah, with Data dreaming, like, but that, so that would be, what, 20 minutes? Mm. So, could we stretch Data dreaming out for 20 minutes?
Yes.
And then cram Worf, but the thing is, then, if you try to cram Worf searching for his father, not finding his father, ending up in this prison camp, and, like, to me, it's just, like, it just becomes meaningless goop.
At least if you have it as a one-parter, James Cromwell doesn't have his stunt double play all his scenes in part two.
I'm still fascinated by that whole stunt double situation. I if James Cromwell ever comes to a convention, I need to ask him what happened with his broken leg or what have you. It was weird and comedic and unintentionally comedic where, guys, just if you don't recall, there's a sequence where, you know, a guy who's clearly not James Cromwell, but he's dressed like the same alien. He's sneaking around and not talking at all when he's playing the alien in part two, I believe.
Yeah, that's right.
So
yeah, I gave the award to the same episode. It's not my, you know, Birthright was not my bottom pick for, you know, in ranking them. But there isn't, why is this a two-parter? I just kept asking myself that over and over again from the first time I watched it, straight up through rewatching it, and then through the whole episode in which we reviewed it.
To me, this is the one that it'd just be toughest to convince me to watch it again. I'm just like, why am I punishing myself? Like, this is...
I could rewatch it. It's Gambit that I would be more like...
Okay.
Yeah, not too happy about having to revisit.
Well.
Okay, so I think on that note, our assignment is complete. If you enjoyed listening to this podcast, we want to hear from you. Send your thoughts and feedback to subspacetransmissionspod@gmail.com. Send us your lists of what order you would rank the two-parters. Are we, you know, wrong about any of these? Should we give any of these reappraisals? Did we miss the point of any of them? I would love to hear from you guys. Okay, so you can also reach us on the Twitter. I'm at Cam V is in very much done with TNG two-parters. Bring on DS9, Smith.
You can find me at Reportin. That's R. R as in Romulans embedded on Vulcan. E-P-O-R-T-O-N.
I almost went with that, actually. I was going to say Vulcans against embedded Romulans.
You could still.
Okay, so until next time, the arena is closed.
Transfer complete.